Hello. My name is Kirk McKenzie, the founder of DefendRuralAmerica.com. I'm concerned about what's going on in our country and our world and doing what I can to turn things around. This morning I'm talking to noted attorney Karen Budd Follin from Cheyenne, Wyoming. Karen, good morning.
Good morning.
Would you like to give a brief background about yourself, your company, what got you into this, what, you know, your practice is and what you do?
Sure. I am an attorney in Cheyenne, Wyoming. My husband and I own a firm. We have five attorneys working for us. The entire focus of our firm is property rights, constitutional law, and protecting rural America. I grew up as a fifth-generation rancher on a family-owned ranch in Big Piney, Wyoming, so ownership of the land and the care for the land is absolutely near and dear to my heart, as well as to the people that I represent.
And for the listeners out there, let me add to that, is Karen really is very well recognized as one of the people who really is truly on fighting on behalf of America and the rural America and taking kind of a leadership role in that, which is why I am very pleased today to have an opportunity to talk to you. The issue here is the opposition that wants to seem to change our country so dramatically in the rural area seems to have an endless amount of money to do what they're doing, and part of that comes from the Equal Access to Justice Act. And I know that you're, as soon as I kind of heard about that for the first time, I immediately discovered that you're in the midst of it, and so I was very eager to get your inputs on that. So maybe you can give us a little bit of a background about the act, what it does, how it's being, used and abused, and we'll eventually get around to talking about some of the things you're doing and trying to come up with solutions. So give us a little background about the act to start with so people know what it is.
Certainly. The Equal Access to Justice Act was an act that was signed into law by President Reagan. The purpose of the act was to put people back in the same position as they were before they were forced to sue the federal government. Sometimes the government makes bad decisions. Sometimes the government does that without any sort of factual or legal basis at all. And to remedy those decisions, people have to resort to the courts. So the thought behind the Equal Access to Justice Act is that if the federal government made a bad decision and if the government was not substantially justified, that the person suing the government should be put back in the same monetary position as before, and they should have their attorney's fees reimbursed. The act was not set out as some sort of a money-making scheme. The act was not set out as a political statement. It was simply so that low-income citizens or small groups or small businesses would have the means to be able to recoup funding if they were successful in their litigation.
Okay, so effectively the policy was, for good reasons, was that the federal government would give money to sue the federal government, pay people to sue it, but it had a well-intended idea of equalizing things for the smaller person or individual or corporation or entity, so they had a way to kind of effectively hold the government to account. So then what's happened to it since, and how is it being used now?
Well, and initially, though, it wasn't that the government was paying people to sue it. What the government was doing was reimbursing people for attorney's fees if the government lost the case.
Okay.
And so you couldn't even get attorney's fees unless you won, and then you met some threshold requirements about size, about net worth, and the payments made to the attorneys were, you know, pretty modest of payments. They were $125 an hour, which, if anyone's paid an attorney an hourly fee, is a fairly modest fee for an attorney. So that was the purpose of the law. What happened was then is in 1995, Bill Clinton signed the Paperwork Reduction Act, and one of the pieces of paper that was reduced was an accounting for these attorney's fees. And so since 1995, the federal government has had absolutely no idea how much money is being paid out in attorney's fees under the Equal Justice Act. There's no accountability. There is no way to find this money. And the federal government simply hasn't tracked any of the money. If you write a letter to the Justice Department and say, how many times have you been sued in a certain time period by a named group, Justice Department can't tell you, which seems pretty amazing to me considering that when you sue the federal government, they're represented by the Justice Department. But the Justice Department itself can't tell you how many times a certain federal agency has been sued. And so that was one problem, is that any tracking for this money has just simply ceased to exist.
Okay.
The other problem, then, is you had environmental groups, and in my opinion, they are the worst abusers. They figured out how to sort of get around the protections for the American public in the Equal Access to Justice Act. For example, under the Equal Access to Justice Act, if your net worth is over $7 million, you cannot receive reimbursement of attorney's fees. The thought being that if your net worth is over $7 million, you've got enough financial ability to sue the federal government without this additional assistance. However, that net worth cap does not apply to nonprofit businesses or IRS tax-exempt businesses. And so the Sierra Club, whose tax-exempt forms show that its net worth is $56 million, can still get attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Or the Center for Biological Diversity, whose own tax forms show that it's worth over $7 million, those groups can get reimbursed for attorney's fees. But if you're a business, if you're an individual, you can't get that same reimbursement. And so that's one of the areas where the act has gotten totally off key. Another area that it's really gotten off key is in terms of the hourly fee paid. Under the Equal Access to Justice Act, an attorney is only supposed to be reimbursed up to $125 an hour. Well, what these environmental groups have figured out is that by using add-ons and by using all these additional funds, we've seen payments in California now at $650 an hour for an attorney in California representing an environmental group. We're also seeing these, quote, nonprofit law firms like Earth Justice Legal Foundation or Western Environmental Law Center who simply do not charge their clients, and they make their money from litigating against the federal government for return of attorney's fees. There's an attorney group called Advocates for the West, which is based in Boise, Idaho. And according to the IRS documents, we've been able to look at well over half of its funding comes from reimbursement for attorney's fees. And that is simply not the way the Equal Access to Justice Act was set up, and that is definitely not what was intended when President Reagan signed that act into law in the 1980s.
Amazing. So basically this whole industry has developed to not only make, I guess, massive profits by suing the federal government, but also at the same time to really change the legal landscape and government regulational control over rural America. I know that there's lawsuits, you know, if they don't win, you know, with legislation, then there's lawsuits, and they seem to be non-ending and perpetually funded. This seems to be part of the source of that funding. How do they actually get around these limits, for example, the $125 an hour limit? Are they throwing in expenses or something? Or
Well, no, they claim that environmental litigation on behalf of an environmental group is a specialty, and then they put in all these cost of living raises. And the other frustrating thing is that if I apply for Equal Access to Justice Act Fund on behalf of one of my clients have already paid my bills. And so the money that I receive from the government goes straight to the clients. But for these groups, they haven't already paid their attorney's fees. And so the amount of money paid to them is absolutely a windfall because they're not being reimbursed. They're just coming up with hours and then with fees and saying we have to have add-ons, and even though we may live in a small town, we should be able to charge the same rates that they charge in San Francisco or L.A., and the courts are agreeing with that. And even worse, in approximately a third of the cases, the U.S. Justice Department is simply settling with these groups without any kind of a court order or a court decision. So the U.S. Justice Department is simply agreeing to pay these ridiculous attorney fees per hour and to pay money to these, quote, nonprofit public interest groups that certainly aren't acting in my public interest.
It's amazing to me. They figured out the system here. Is this happening across the country, or is it predominantly happening in the western states?
Oh, no, this is absolutely happening across the country. This whole phenomenon we're seeing in dealing with Clean Air Act issues, Clean Water Act issues, endangered species issues, this is not a private lands versus public lands phenomenon. This is, in my opinion, simply an environmental bent phenomenon where environmental groups are making significant amounts of money from the taxpayers. And so the taxpayers are really paying for everything because the taxpayers are paying for the money reimbursed to the environmental group. The tax money is being paid for the Justice Department to defend the case. Tax money is being paid to the federal agencies who made the decision in the first place. And a lot of times when an environmental group challenges the decision, the private landowner or the person impacted will have to intervene and pay his own attorney to be able to protect his rights in his private property or to be able to protect his use of his water rights or his public lands.
It's pretty amazing. This is happening, I know, in Siskiyou County, and I'm sure you have an even broader range of scope of knowledge, but effectively, we're paying for our own demise. I mean, we've gotten to that point. It's really crazy. Do you believe that this is all under the federal government that this occurs, correct? It's not a state issue. It's a federal government.
At this point, we are only looking at the federal government.
Okay. So do you believe that there is a slant in the federal orientation, that they're biased towards paying off environmental groups and not other kinds of groups? Do you think it's slanted, or do you think that it's just – it appears to me that the environmental side of this, the people who are attacking rural America, have really figured this game out. Are there any on our side that have tried to do this and been turned down by the federal government, or is it that we haven't figured it out, the system? I mean, I assume that if this is available to one side, it should be available to the other side.
In theory, if it's available to one side, it should be available to the other side. But in practice, that's not the way it's working. If you look at the system, all federal courts are included on a database called PACER. And so we have, in this law firm, since the federal government does not do it, we have looked at various federal courts for various groups and tracked the amount of money and sort of who gets paid what. We have found cases where a property rights group or a rancher or a small business has sued the federal government and has won and has had attorney's fees reimbursed. But in 98% of the cases, these small groups, these people that the act was meant for, are not being reimbursed. I have received attorney's fees. We have a very successful law practice here. I've received attorney's fees 5 times in 22 years.
Is it because not winning, or because there's a bias in the system?
I think there's a bias in the system because, quite frankly, when I sue the federal government or my clients want to sue the federal government, our goal is to take power away from the government, is to put power back in the hands of the citizen, is to protect private property rights, is to protect economic stability. The goal of the bureaucracy is, quite frankly, not to protect private property rights, not to put power back into the hands of the citizens. When environmental groups sue the government gets more power. It gets to enact more regulations. It gets to have more control over people's lives. And the anecdotal evidence that I found shows that the federal government is much more willing to settle litigation when it has the ability to enact more regulations and exert more control than in cases where the court is trying to take power away from the federal government.
Now, you were mentioning that part of this is that the way you do your practice, you're a for-profit corporation, and so you charge your clients and look towards reimbursement. On the other hand, they're doing it as a nonprofit. Presumably, they have donors that are giving them money as well, and they're more or less taking the case pro bono with the expectation they'll win or settle and they'll get money from the federal government. Is there an equivalent organization on our side, you know, equivalent to this, what, Western Environmental Law Center or Advocates for the West? I mean, is there an equivalent nonprofit group that's pursuing this from the other side, our side?
You mean that's attempting to sue the federal government?
Yeah, that's a nonprofit organization.
Yes, we have groups like Pacific Legal Foundation or Mountain States Legal Foundation. There are certainly groups who are on this side who are attempting to make a difference to protect property rights and to protect citizens' rights to make a living. But as I said, when you look at settlement with the federal government and you look at the number of cases settled, the federal government is much more likely to settle cases where they get to create regulations and have more power than they are to settle a case where they would have to delete regulations or lessen their power over the citizens of the United States.
Yeah, that's amazing to me. Now, I know that you're taking kind of an active role here in trying to fix this act and make it accountable. So why don't you go ahead and talk about your efforts?
Yes. I quite honestly believe that if we can shut off some of the money to these environmental groups, there will be less money for litigating in attempting to litigate us out of business. And so we have been very actively looking at legislation to attempt to get the Equal Access to Justice Act back to where it was before, back to the original tent when Ronald Reagan signed the law. Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis from Wyoming has introduced a bill called the Governmental Litigation Savings Act, which would go a long ways in, A, forcing an accounting of the money, because no matter what side of the aisle you're on, I can't believe that you would support hidden fees and the federal government simply hiding money. And so part of the act would be to force a transparency and a force an accounting of how much money is paid to all different groups. And the second part of the act would be to equalize, for example, for-profit and non-profit businesses and set a hard cap on the amount of attorney's fees that can be reimbursed. So that environmental groups can't argue that they should get $650 an hour when I do not believe their attorneys will ever be paid $650 an hour.
Now, do they have Cynthia Lewis, you said, and her legislation, is there a website or something that's been built to inform people about this?
Yes, there's a group called the Western Legacy Alliance. They have copies of the legislation and information about it on their website. Congresswoman Loomis from Wyoming also has information on her website. This bill has now passed the House Judiciary Committee, and we are very much hoping that it comes to the full floor of the House in March of 2012. So we've stepped over one big hurdle, and we are ready for the next.
Is there a bill number assigned to it?
Yes. I will have to look that up, but I will certainly let you know what that is.
Okay, and I'll put a link up on the Defend Rural America website to all this, too. So it's called the Western what Alliance?
Western Legacy Alliance.
Legacy Alliance. So basically, we should try and direct a lot of support to this and to the congressman and to this act.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. And there's a...
And I can tell you the bill number is H.R. 1996.
H.R. 1996.
Yes.
Okay. Do you happen to know where the presidential candidates stand on this by any chance?
No, I don't.
That'd be interesting to know.
I can also tell you that there is a much smaller version pending in the Senate right now, simply because of the makeup of the Senate. That bill would require transparency and accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're hoping is that that bill can make it through the Senate, and then bringing these bills together in conference committee can come up with some meaningful relief and stop the giant flow of money to these environmental groups.
Now, to pass the Senate, you're going to have a lot of Democrat support, right?
Yes.
Have you found that it's always amazing to me, these issues like this should be an American issue, not a political issue, and yet it seems to become that with almost everything. You know, the parties take a position, and the parties seem to have sway over their people and control their votes instead of voting for how their constituents, they seem to vote with the party. But is the expectation here we're going to get some, both sides of the aisle working together on this?
I sincerely hope so. I do very little lobbying. I do a lot more information giving, but they tell me that they believe that something like this would help. Senator Barrasso from Wyoming is working on this, as well as one of the senators from back east. And I can get you that name and number here in a minute.
Yeah, that would really be good because, one of my philosophies is, on the conservative side, I hate to use the word conservative, I like to say the American side of the equation, but there seems to be a lot of people seem to be willing to yell at the bad guys and spend a lot of time wasting their time, saying, I don't like this person, I don't like that person, they're bad. I don't know how many emails I see that are on that side of the equation, and there's virtually none saying, hey, here's a good guy. This is what this good guy just did for us. And, hey, this is the good guy's website. And this is their newsletter. Sign up. But, basically recognize who's good and then work to make, help those people get a bigger voice, get a bigger audience, get their word out, get funding for reelection. I think that we have to change our orientation from this negative orientation towards who's against us in a positive orientation, figure out who's for us, and get behind those people. So I really very much would like to have the other senator's name, too, and I'll put all that up there.
Okay.
There was one point I wanted to, I kind of skipped over, and I forgot. I'm going to go backwards a little bit, and then we'll return to this point. I've heard I can't remember, Karen, if it was you or someone else was kind of giving me an example of a system, how it works, and essentially it was a serial lawsuit, I'll call it that. There was... on one particular issue, the environmental side filed three lawsuits on the same issue and won money on all three. Was that you that was telling me about that?
I don't know if I was the one that was telling you the story. I absolutely know that it happens.
Go ahead and give us...
Particularly on endangered species issues.
Go ahead and give us an example of that, because I think that shocked me. I mean, it's not just get paid for one lawsuit. You can double dip, triple dip. Give an example.
Okay. I think one of the saddest examples, in my opinion, that I've ever heard is over this little grass species, plant species called the slick spot pepper grass. The Western Watersheds Project, which is an environmental group in Idaho, has been calling for the listing and protection of this slick spot pepper grass for years. The first time that under the Endangered Species Act, if a citizen or a group petitions to have a species listed, the federal government has to respond to that petition in 90 days. The problem is that groups like Center for Biological Diversity and Wild Earth Guardians have discovered this, and they file thousands of listing petitions. And there is simply no way that even if the federal government wanted to, that they can respond to all of those petitions. So the environmental groups then, on the 91st day, can file a case in federal district court requiring the federal government to review the petition in some time certain and get their attorney's fees paid, not because the species ought to be listed, but because the federal government missed a time deadline. And we are seeing hundreds and hundreds of lawsuits, not over whether species ought to be listed, but simply whether the federal government missed a 90-day time frame or a 180-day time frame or a certain time frame. So in the case of this slick spot pepper grass, there was a petition to list the species, and the Fish and Wildlife Service, rather than listing the species, and I mean, there's lots of details in the middle, but eventually the federal government came to meet with the governor of the state of Idaho, the landowners, the Bureau of Land Management, anyone that was impacted by this species, and said, rather than listing the species, let's create a conservation plan. And let's do fencing and let's do grazing management and all sorts of things so that we are actually doing something on the ground. You know, we're going to assume that this species needs protection, and so we are going to do all these marvelous things on the ground. The environmental group decided that it didn't really matter what all these wonderful things on the ground were. They've litigated now over the species three times. The conservation plan that these ranchers spent so much time and so much money on is completely out the window, even though the conservation plan was working, and Western Watersheds Project has received over $200,000 for litigating over a plant in Idaho.
It's just amazing. It's just amazing. Now, it seems like effectively this Endangered Species Act has almost turned control over to these radical environmentalists. All they have to do is, they don't even have to file suit to say, hey, it's in the danger, or, you know, the species is about to go extinct. They just say, hey, you know, we want a response on this. And so, I mean, they could literally go ahead and file those kind of things on every species on Earth, I guess. When they do that, so the government has to respond. So all of a sudden, government is now kind of the servant to these requests. And in the process of these requests, are these groups essentially forcing government to, you know, government doesn't know how many caribou are up in this area or how many, you know, salmon are over here. Are they being forced through this process to start doing statistical measuring of all the species that are being requested?
No. Because the Endangered Species Act does not require the agency to know how many species there are before it's listed. They just have to do a literature search to determine if somebody believes that there are less now than there were back sometime in the past. And so species can be listed on the Endangered Species Act when nobody has any real idea how many there are. The other thing we're starting to see is the Obama administration has now issued a draft policy that they're asking for public comments on, related to expansion of the definition of critical habitat. Critical habitat is supposed to be the area where the animal is located that needs protected. But in sort of lay terms, what the Obama administration is proposing is let's include critical habitat in places where species may feel like living someday. And so it's going to greatly expand the area of land taken up by critical habitat for an endangered species. The problem with both listing and critical habitat designation is that once a species is listed, or once critical habitat is designated, take of a species is absolutely prohibited, except under very certain circumstances that don't apply in 99% of the cases. And habitat modification is also prohibited. So, for example, here in Wyoming, there have been pushes to list the Preble's meadow jumping mouse. And there's a lot of scientific controversy over whether the Preble's meadow jumping mouse is different than any other normal kind of jumping mouse. But the concern is that now that the Preble's has been forced by a court to be listed, this Preble lives in riparian areas on ranch land in eastern Wyoming. Once those areas are designated critical habitat, there is a very real possibility that ranchers will not be able to use riparian areas, their cows will not be able to get to water because of a concern that the cows will eat the habitat, modify the habitat, which would be a prohibited take under the Endangered Species Act.
Amazing to me. I'm going to head back and have you define a couple terms. So riparian, you're referring to the vegetation and so forth along a river or a creek, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so when they expand into the riparian areas, essentially they're taking what they've always tried to do through some multiple methods is the controlling the access to the water. The word take you've used, why don't you take a moment and explain take?
Okay, a take is a term that has been defined under the Endangered Species Act as harass, shoot, harm, endanger, or attempt to do any of the above, which would harm a listed species or adversely modify critical habitat.
Okay, so essentially if a farmer wants
anything.
I assume that when they designate this habitat, this isn't just affecting public lands. This is now affecting private property. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Critical habitat is not simply tied to public lands. Neither are listed species. And so this could be across somebody's, 2-acre home site or any other private property. There's no boundary limitations on the Endangered Species Act at all.
So I'm going to just throw out an example. Maybe it's not an accurate one, perhaps kind of to make the point here. So essentially, if critical habitat is designated, and this is an area where maybe an animal will come into at some point in time in the future of this habitat, and they decide that you have to have a certain kind of a brush for this potential animal to move into or whatever else, and you have your 2-acre lot, maybe you can't take the brush down and put it in a lawn. I mean, the level of control that this gives is extreme.
Well, in Southern California, I can't remember how many years ago it was, but there was a huge problem when they listed the kangaroo rat because people who lived in Southern California had, all of these, 5-acre lots and 2-acre lots, and they wanted to take down brush to stop fire danger. Because once a fire gets started in the very dry Southern California desert, it is so easy to burn out of control, and there were a lot of private property owners not allowed to cut down brush on their own private property for fear of harming habitat for the kangaroo rat. And a lot of homes burned over the same problem.
The other part of this thing that you mentioned in passing here, I want to point, is that you said that it's not that they're necessarily, a listing doesn't necessarily mean that they're endangered. What it means is they're just not at the historical levels. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
So it's not
the
like,
other thing it can mean, though, is that even if we're starting to see now that even if the species is at historical levels, if they believe that the size of the habitat is smaller, then that could also cause a listing. One of the issues that is recently come up is what to do with the buffalo, the wild plains buffalo.
Well, that's what I was going to come to next. But so basically, people need to understand the act. You know, most people think, and I've always thought, that the Endangered Species Act was there to save a species from going extinct. And that's, and I'm learning in Siskiyou County, has nothing to do with extinction. And the way they're defining this, like you're saying now, I think the buffalo will be a prime example. If the criteria is that, you know, you have to meet historical levels and they have to have their natural habitat to support the historical levels.
Or the historical size of the habitat.
The historical size of the habitat. Well, heck, you know, the buffalo ranged across the entire West United States. So that means we're going to take out all towns, villages, ranches, farms. I mean, that's the kind of implication. I mean, that's the inevitable end result of that kind of a policy.
That is the inevitable end result. The environmental groups have petitioned now the federal government to list the buffalo as a threatened or endangered species, and the federal government has committed that it is going to make a decision on that listing petition. So, I mean, these examples sound so crazy, you don't think that anyone would ever actually do this or enforce this, but this is all happening right now.
It's amazing. So the criteria that's being established, in fact, is historical numbers with historical amount of habitat. I know that they were doing this with the coho salmon, and then they're going further and saying, well, a hatchery fish doesn't qualify because that's somehow different from a fish that hatches in the stream. And so by the definition of the, I don't know where that's actually built into the act or the way it's being interpreted, but by the very definition, it's inevitably leading to a result of wiping out most of our progress and civilization here and moving lands back to some kind of a native condition. I mean, and I presume that means that, you know, Native Indians have control over all this. You know, everybody, all Europeans go back to Europe and all Africans go back to Africa. I don't know how it works, but it's an inevitable direction this is going in unless people begin to wake up to understand that this act really has nothing to do with species extinction or protection.
Well, I have to tell you, it was very interesting. The House Resources Committee in December had a hearing on whether litigation is driving decisions under the Endangered Species Act, and I testified in front of the House Committee along with a gentleman named Corinne Suckling, who is the executive director, founder of the Center for Biological Diversity. And his big complaint, in addition to the fact that we're not saving enough creatures, is that there's simply too many people on the earth. And so he advocates for population control and that kind of thing. So it wouldn't be just turning the land back over to the Native Americans. It is getting rid of people.
Yeah, I know that I've heard some numbers that suggest a radical reduction in the population from 7 billion to like 500 million. I mean, and it sounds like, you know, somebody's being crazy to suggest that that's even being considered, but that is being considered. I mean, it's amazing. What we used to think was radical seems to be moving into the mainstream, and through things like the Endangered Species Act and these groups that seem to be getting all this funding. So returning to this Equal Access to Justice Act, in terms of solutions, so one thing that people can do is get behind this particular H.R. 1996 and the related Senate bill, start supporting these people, understand the importance of this act. If individuals wanted to have more transparency while waiting around for this to pass through Congress, do they have the ability to file a Freedom of Information Act request to get some of this information on in their local area?
You can certainly do that, but in my experience, through filing Freedom of Information Act requests, the federal government simply doesn't have the information. And even at the congressional hearing, when pressed, neither the Fish and Wildlife Service nor NOAA Fisheries were very excited at all in turning information on attorney's fees payments over to the federal government. The way we were able to track it in this law firm is to use a federal court database called PACER, mm-hmm. where you can look at the federal court database. You can type in the name of any plaintiff you want, for example, Sierra Club or Center for Biodiversity or whoever. It will pull up a list of every single court case that group has filed in that particular federal court. Then you can it's a slow process, go through and start tracking the money paid to these groups. We have done that for 19 states in the District of Columbia, looking at 13 environmental groups, and we found $36 million had been paid in attorney's fees to these groups. With strictly regard to California, we in California looked at the Center for Biological Diversity. The Center for Biological Diversity, just in the federal courts in California, had filed 149 cases between 2000 and 2009 and received $3,626,000 in attorney's fees. During that same time period, only in California, the Sierra Club filed 98 lawsuits and received a total of $7,414,000 in attorney's fees.
Now,
those are the only two groups I looked at in California.
Yeah, well, that's good. I mean, what was the time period?
2000 to 2009.
All right. Did you have any of that posted, by the way, on your website or anything?
Yes, we have that posted on. We have all the numbers we tracked on our website as well as on the Western Legacy Alliance website. These numbers are posted.
Okay, maybe afterwards you can have somebody send me a link to the relevant part of your website. Sometimes websites are so big I can't wade through them.
Okay, well, ours is pretty easy. If you go to Bud Fallon Law Office and then you look under the link that says attorney fees, it's all right there.
Oh, okay. Got it. So go ahead. If somebody wants now to follow up and contact you, how would they do that?
The easiest way is through the website. We have our phone number and an email address on there.
Okay, so go ahead and say, give us the phone.
Sure. The phone number is 307-632-5105.
Okay, and the website address again?
Is Main, M-A-I-N. At Bud Fallon, it's my last name with no hyphen. It's B as in boy, U, D, D, F as in Frank, A, L, E, N, .com.
Okay, and so the website, that would be your email address, your phone number, and the website obviously is then www.budfallon.com?
Yes.
Okay. This is excellent. Are there any final closing comments that you'd like to make?
I think one of the most important thing that your listeners need to keep in mind is that this really is not simply a rancher fight or a public land fight. If people in these rural areas can't produce food, it's a national security issue. The United States has got the safest form of food in the nation, or in the world. We can produce our own timber. We can produce our own energy. We need to be able to keep these rural communities. We need to keep rural families. We need to keep our rural areas intact. Whether you're talking about rural areas in Northern California or Wyoming or Arkansas, because we all have the same issues. And it truly is where our food and all of our goods and materials come from. And I'm afraid sometimes people who live in the cities don't keep that connection in mind. And so when you're supporting rural America, you're really supporting yourselves because you're supporting your food source, your energy source, your housing source. And so we are all tied together through rural America, and we need to be strong and vigilant in supporting each other so that America continue to be the country that it is.
You know, I think those are excellent points. You know, I think that we've had it so good for so long, we really take for granted really the backbone of our nation. I mean, what built this nation and what really is keeping this nation going. I mean, the rural America is really, you think about it in terms of, like you say, it's our water, it's our energy, which means your home heating and your ability to drive your car and have the liberty that brings along with it and the freedom of job choice and so forth. It is your food. It is your, you know, your building materials like gravel and concrete and, you know, the things that make bricks. I mean, it's all the sources of our minerals and so forth. And our timber, of course. And all of that is under attack. I mean, every single element of that is under attack. I mean, they're going after the water. There is not an energy source that the environmentalists like except for solar and wind, which are extremely expensive, inefficient, ugly, and kill animals. I mean, those blades rotating on those windmills kill hawks all the time here in California, so they're not so friendly after all. But they hate hydropower, it appears. They're going after gasoline, they're going after coal, they're going after nuclear. I mean, they're basically trying to eliminate the energy independence or so forth. And same thing has happened with food. I mean, we have exported so many of our industries. We no longer, you know, build shoes here or clothes here, or, you know, you can go on and on and on. So many of the blue-collar jobs were exported offshore. Then all of a sudden we exported, you know, whole industries offshore, and now we've exported technology offshore. When somebody buys an iPhone or iPad, 80-85% of the components that go inside that thing, hey, that's, you know, Korea, that's Japan, it's Taiwan, it's, you know, mainland China. We've exported our technologies, and with this we've exported our expertise. And, you know, here we are, have been the food basket of the world. And we're realizing even that's now under assault. We cannot, as a country, expect to import all of our stuff and go into massive amounts of debt, continually going into massive amounts of debt for this stuff to other countries, and expect to remain sovereign or secure. And it absolutely is a security issue. It's a sovereignty issue. And I agree wholeheartedly with you, and appreciate the fact you made those closing comments. I would encourage listeners, there will be links, go to these that we've talked about. There will be links to these on the Defend Rural America website. And Karen, I greatly appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. I was happy to visit with you.
Thank you.